I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. In fact, when they invited me, I felt obligated to warn them that I wasn't exactly sure how this talk fits into the overall list of topics for the meeting. And they said, don't worry, but in hopes of somehow justifying my presence, I'll try to make some connections with number theory and indirectly with Shimura varieties. So what I'd like to speak about is all joint work with Peter Schneider and also some work by other people, which I am going to present more or less by way of an advertisement, on the study of a representation theory of p-adic groups in p-adic vector spaces. And this development of this was motivated initially by a number of questions, but I think at the back of our minds was always the hope that there might prove to be some connection with number theory and p-adic Galois representations, and there's now some indications that there might be some justification for that hope. So that's the meaning of the term inklings in the title, although it's all very preliminary. So let me outline what I plan to do. I thought I'd start by giving you an overview of p-adic representation theory. And then give you some of the basic examples in this business. Then I'd like to talk a bit about somehow what's been my and Schneider's main involvement in this work, which is the search for a reasonable notion of admissibility for these representations. And then finally, at the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about work of Christoph Breu. And in my abstract, I think I said that I would also talk a little bit about work of Emerton, but I may not have time to say more than just a little tiny bit about Matthew Emerton's work, which is related to all of this. Okay. So let me start by giving you an overview of the problem. Somehow the problem is motivated by the consideration that if you start with a real Lie group, then there's only somehow one kind of representation theory that you are interested in. And by that I mean somehow that both the finite dimensional representations and at the same time the kind of infinite dimensional representations, although these theories are, of course, this one is vastly more complicated, at least this one is contained in that one. That is to say, the finite dimensional representations are smooth representations of Lie groups. But in the p-adic world, you have on the one hand, you can view your p-adic group, say, as an algebraic group, and then you have finite dimensional representations, such as those coming from highest weights. And on the other hand, you have smooth representation theory, such as those which occur in the Langlands program. And except for the trivial representation, these are essentially disjoint from one another. And this is somehow aesthetically unsatisfying. And so one way to look at the objective of this kind of representation theory is to find a bigger class of p-adic analytic representations, which includes both of these. So that's one point of view on this type of theory. A second observation that you can make is that if you look at the Galois side of this picture, in the L-adic case, you have this the Langlands correspondence locally, let's say, which relates smooth representations and representations of the vague group. But if you try to think about what a p-adic version of such a thing might be, you see immediately that the smooth representations are not enough. Because, first of all, the smooth representations don't capture enough information to characterize p-adic Galois representations. And second of all, smooth representations are in some sense rigid. They don't deform. p-adically, whereas p-adic Galois representations do move in families, as was shown by Hida and then many other people since then. And so if you accept the fact that p-adic Galois representations deform, then you need some kind of representation theory which permits construction of families of representations, and smooth representations are too rigid. So the analytic representations allow for this. So these are two motivations for why you might be interested in this more general kind of representation theory. On the other hand, once you decide that this would be a good plan, you immediately run into two. So what kind of thing might you look at? Well, for example, you could consider representations of a p-adic group in a p-adic Banach space, such as take the functions, the continuous p-adic functions on the group, and let the group act on that. Or take the functions which are analytic on the group and let the group act on that. And you immediately run into two observations which tell you that you've got big problems. So the two big problems are, on the one hand, you don't have Haar measure. I mean, you have it, of course, it's there, but it has the property that subgroups of p-adic groups tend to have index p to the n. So small subgroups tend to have index a large power of p, and so their measure grows. Small groups have big measure. And therefore, you can't integrate anything against this measure. And second of all, you have no Hilbert spaces. In other words, you have no unitary theory, because you don't have any notion of positivity in the p-adic, so you have no notion of a positive definite form. And so you have no unitary theory. And I think the moral of these two things is that it's a completely different ballgame. Now, the combination somehow, I mean, one consequence of this is that you're going to be forced to work with Banach spaces, or at best, or possibly more general topological vector spaces. And it's well known, even for real Lie groups, that if you study representations in kind of a general topological vector space, there are many pathologies which come up. Many of the pathologies, so for representations in general topological vector spaces, the classic problem that you have is the following. You have a G invariant map V to W, and the problem is that you can't say that the image is closed. This is the typical kind of problem that you run into. So the image of a G invariant map won't be closed. So just to give you, I mean, This causes problems in many different ways. I mean, for example, there's no kind of Schur's lemma that you can have if you just work with general Banach spaces. So you have to do something to fix this, and in particular, you obviously are going to have to impose some kind of finiteness condition on the representations in order to avoid these pathologies. Okay, so let me give you the two basic definitions for the kinds of representations that we want to consider, because as it turns out, it's good to consider both kinds. So the two kinds, so the basic definitions, and I guess we might call the first kind although it's a little bit misleading because both are continuous, but we tend to call these a continuous representation. So here in general, let me just say, the kind of groups that I'm interested in for the moment are, I take, let's say, the field QP, and I have a finite extension of QP, L, and then I have a finite extension of that K, all of which is, let's say, contained in some big field CP. K is going to be the coefficient field for my representations in general, and L is going to be the field of definition for the group. Okay, so it's like the L-valued points of a group, and with the representations take values in some space K. So a continuous and now for the moment, let's take G to be L analytic, which means that, I mean, this is more general than let's say coming from an algebraic group. It just means that it's covered by charts which look like open disks in the field L, and the gluing maps are given by convergent power series, not rigid analysis, but kind of the old-fashioned kind of p-adic analysis where you just look at convergent power series on disks. So a continuous representation is to give a K-Banach space. Well, for the moment, yeah. I mean, if it's L analytic, I mean, often I'm going to be considering the case where G is compact and L analytic. So then if G is also discrete, this theory is still interesting, but different. So for the maybe we could even say compact, although because of this lack of Haar measure, even compact groups are interesting in this situation. I mean, the Peter Weil theorem is false. So the continuous representation of G is a K-Banach space, E, and a continuous in the sense it's continuous in both variables. Continuous action of G on E. By linear maps, of course. And the second kind of representation, so I mean, this may be a better name for this would be called a Banach space representation, except we call it continuous because it's associated with continuous functions. The second kind of representation is a locally analytic representation, and this one is a bit more technical. So a locally analytic representation is given by, and I will say these words for the sake of people who would like to know the actual definitions, but I won't discuss them further. It's a barreled, locally convex Hausdorff topological vector space K, a V over K, with a continuous action by G. Well, by that, maybe that's a poor choice of terminology. With an action of G by continuous maps. And even more, you require that, and this is the key point, the orbit maps on G where you send V to GV, you think of, for fixed V, are analytic on G, locally analytic on G. Locally analytic, again, means in the naive sense. So in other words, the action can be expressed by somehow, I mean, on a particular vector, the action of G is given by a convergent power series on some p-adic neighborhood in G with coefficients in the vector space V. That's the right way to think about it. G goes to GV. Thank you. So the action of G can be expressed by power series. So let me give you some examples of the kinds of things that we're talking about here. What you actually do is you choose, I mean, this condition really means that you pick a Banach space which somehow maps to V, and your analytic function is then considered relative to takes values in this Banach space which embeds continuously into V, and there's some technicalities hidden here. Although it's the same thing that you would do in somehow real analysis, I think, if you have to. No, not as it's written, although under some conditions it follows. Okay, so let me give you the basic examples. So first of all, Well, the finite dimensional, they are of both types. Namely, if W is a finite dimensional space and the action is by, let's say, a rational representation of a Lie group, p-adic Lie group, then of course, I mean, the finite dimensional space is a Banach space, and these orbit maps are just the polynomial, are polynomial functions on G. And since polynomials are locally analytic, this is an example of both a Banach space representation and a locally analytic representation. Okay, a second example is to take a smooth representation. Smooth in the sense that the stabilizers of vectors are open. Now, this, if it's infinite dimensional, these are locally analytic, but in general not, I mean, they're not going to be a Banach space representation. Here, the topology, if you like, is the one that you get by just decreeing that the finite dimensional subspaces are closed. I mean, you think of this as a direct limit of finite dimensional spaces. And that will make this a locally analytic representation in this sense. Well, okay, now you can finally do something that you couldn't do before, namely you can take type 1, tensor type 2. Oh, by the way, I should say, in this case, the orbit maps are locally constant functions. That's what it means to have a smooth representation. So locally constant functions are locally analytic. Okay? So this is what you might call a locally algebraic representation. And it has the property that orbit maps are locally polynomial on G. Here I have to probably put some conditions on G. I mean, in this case, let's suppose, just take G. I mean, I tend to always think about this case. Take G to actually be the points of an algebraic group. And now, to give you a new example, you can, well, just let's be completely concrete for the moment. Take GLN of L, and inside here take a Borel subgroup, and inside there take the maximal torus, and, I mean, take a torus inside, and fix a character, which is now not a smooth character, but just either a continuous or a locally analytic function on T. And now you can construct an induction, actually two different kinds of induction, by taking the space of functions F, and you have a choice here. You can either take analytic or continuous from G to K, which satisfy the usual rule. Now, I mean, if your character has to be of the right type, and in this case, you get what you might call either the continuous or locally analytic principal series representation. Okay, and this will turn out to be, depending on whether your character chi was continuous or, I mean, actually all continuous characters turn out to be locally analytic, so it doesn't really matter. But whether you take here all continuous functions with this property or all analytic functions with this property, you will get one of the two different types of representations which are here on this board. Okay. And this is something which is genuinely not, can be different from any of the types which came previously. And now just to, as I said, I was hoping to relate this to this talk. So let me give you a fifth example, which in some ways is maybe the most interesting. So let's let X be Drinfeld's D-dimensional symmetric space. I can't call it omega. And actually, I would like to stamp out the use of the letter omega for it, because as a person who likes to study differential forms on p-adic symmetric spaces, you get really into some self-referential notation if you call it omega, because you have omega of omega. I propose this be eliminated. So d-dimensional Drinfeld's d-dimensional symmetric space, which came up in Ito's talk earlier, and consider the space of d forms on X. This is a rigid variety. You take the rigid analytic d forms, and this turns out to be a Fréchet space. I mean, it's somehow the global sections of a sheaf on a Stein space. And now take not this, but actually its continuous dual. With the strong topology, if you like. And this turns out to be a locally analytic representation. And actually, there's probably nothing special about the D here. I mean, I suspect you can take any coherent sheaf, for example, any coherent equivariant sheaf on Drinfeld symmetric space and take its continuous dual, and I would expect that this would be an example of a locally analytic representation. This means take the continuous dual with the strong topology. This, it's a B. B for strong, yeah. I'm not responsible for that. I mean, you can't blame me. Okay, so now let me give you a good picture to keep in mind when we get into all of this. So take G as GL2. And inside here we have P. Maybe it's the Forel subgroup. And think about the following sequence of vector spaces. We have K, the constants. We have the smooth functions on G mod P. This is P1, of course, with values in K. Okay, so this means locally constant functions. Those sit inside all p-adic locally analytic functions on G mod P. So these are the locally analytic functions. And those sit inside all of the continuous functions on G mod P with values in K. Now, the interesting thing to notice here, so this, by the way, is an example. I mean, these are induced representations from the trivial character on G mod P. This means continuous functions. And in fact, this is already dense in here, okay? By the, what's it called, the Stone-Weierstrass theorem or something like this, some version of that. It's dense, I mean, no, it's already automatically dense in the continuous functions. This is a locally analytic representation, which is, of course, also dense in here, and one of the things you can see from this is that the number of constituents of the continuous representation can be more than you would expect, because if you look at continuous functions, then you would see somehow just one obvious constituent, the constant functions, and other than that, you expect it to be irreducible. But if you look on the level of analytic functions, you see the analytic functions, they have an extra sub-representation given by the locally constant functions. And this is kind of a general phenomenon, that the continuous representations have less, somehow, fewer constituents than the corresponding analytic ones. So this is a good picture to think about, just to see how all of these things fit together. And so now I want to talk for a little bit about part two, which is the question of admissibility. So it turns out that you have to consider different notions of admissibility in the two cases, in the continuous case and in the locally analytic case. So let me deal with the continuous case first. And I'm going to start, I mean, you typically start with the compact case and then from that go to the general case. So now I'm going to assume that G is compact and L analytic. And the goal in this admissibility considerations is to try to eliminate the topological considerations and replace them by algebraic ones. And the general strategy then is to change representations into modules over group algebras. Okay? So there are two different group algebras which come up in the two different settings. In the continuous case, the group algebra which comes up is essentially the Iwasawa algebra of the group. Okay? So if we take the completed group algebra of the group G, this is the inductive limit over subgroups, normal subgroups of finite index of the group algebras. And but since we're actually working over K, I will use the kind of misleading notation to be the tensor product, not the completed, the tensor product like this. And now this is a kind of essentially, I mean, this is the Iwasawa algebra of G, and it was studied by Lazard in great detail. A long time ago, during the classical period of p-adic analysis. Now, this is This is a Noetherian topological algebra. Since I'm avoiding what the exact topology is, I mean, the topology on the Iwasawa algebra is this ring is compact. Okay, it's given, and you can think of it kind of as having it has a weak topology. And so this is not quite a Banach space here, but anyway, this doesn't matter. It's a Noetherian topological algebra, and if you have a continuous representation of G, then its dual becomes a module over this ring. So if V is a continuous representation in that sense, then the continuous dual of that is a K of G module. And the fundamental definition in this case is that we say that V is admissible if its dual is finitely generated. Now, because this is a Noetherian ring, this gives you an abelian category. I mean, there's a little bit of hidden here, the passage between V and V prime, you have to put, in order to go back from V prime to V, you don't put the, I mean, V is a Banach space. V prime, you give a certain topology to, which is arranged so that when you take the dual again, you get back to V. It's not a Banach space topology. But my goal here is not to describe this, and the point is that if V prime is a finitely generated module over this ring, it inherits a canonical topology from the ring. And the questions of topology somehow go away. I mean, the fact that the category is abelian means, for example, that the image of an admissible representation in another is automatically closed, which is the kind of thing that if you have a map between admissible representations. And I should say, so if G is not compact, then V is admissible if V prime is finitely generated for some, or in fact any, compact open subgroup. And the theorem, if you like, is that the admissible continuous representations are in abelian category. In fact, they're just anti-equivalent to the category of finitely generated modules over a particular Noetherian ring. Now, the situation in the locally analytic case is more complicated. And it needs a little bit more functional analysis. So maybe I'll just give you a definition here. So a vector space topological. I mean, it's no category, it's modules over a Noetherian ring. Does every module over a Noetherian ring have finite length? Then I guess not. I mean, I don't see any reason why that should be true. Yeah. This is topologically finitely generated. So, I mean, my impression is that this is not. It's not. At least I don't claim this, although I haven't thought about this specifically. Certainly, in the locally analytic case, it's not true. I mean, you don't expect things. Okay, so a topological vector space is said to be of compact type. If it is a direct limit of Banach spaces with compact transition maps. Now, the only relevance, I mean, this is a nice category of topological vector spaces. The main thing that I will use about it is that they are automatically reflexive. And in fact, and now I'm going to use words that I mean, they're, in the p-adic world, their duals are characterized as, so there's a theorem which says V is compact type if and only if V prime, with my little b for the strong topology, if it's a direct limit of Banach spaces, the dual is a projective limit of Banach spaces, so it's a Frechet space. And the thing which tells you that it's of compact type is that this property nuclear, about which I also won't say anything, but anyway, the point is you can characterize precisely what the duals of such spaces are, and that's important because we always are going back and forth between spaces and their duals. And now I go back to the representation theory case. We have a compact L-analytic group, and we take the space of locally analytic functions on G. Now, this space is, in fact, of compact type, because the way that you construct it is you cover this compact group by p-adic balls, and on each covering by p-adic balls, you take functions which are given by convergent power series relative to that covering. And then you refine the coverings, and you take the limit, the direct limit of these spaces. And the compactness is the fact that if you take a power series which converges on a big disk, and you restrict it to a small disk, this is a compact map of Banach spaces because you get very strong growth conditions on the coefficients, and this basically is what it comes down to. So this is automatically of compact type. And by the way, I should maybe mention, although I didn't define it this way, one way to construct this ring in the case of a compact group is to take the continuous functions on the group and take its dual. So the Iwasawa algebra is, at least as a vector space, the dual of the space of continuous functions on the group. So here what we're going to do is we're going to take the dual of the space of locally analytic functions on the group, and this is called the analytic distribution algebra. And it is a nuclear Frege algebra, which is and the multiplication is continuous, it's jointly continuous as a function of two variables when G is compact. And the amazing thing about it is that although it is neither Noetherian nor commutative, it turns out to have a respectable ring theory, and that's what makes this a respectable module theory, and that's what makes it possible to go any further. So let me just make a couple remarks about this. This is a really interesting ring, I think. I recommend it to people. So I'll just point out that it contains the group itself as the Dirac distributions. This is as the Dirac distributions. It contains the Iwasawa algebra of the group. Because, you see, if you think of the Iwasawa algebra as the dual to the continuous functions, any locally analytic function is in particular continuous. So therefore, if you take a locally analytic function and view it as a continuous function, you can integrate it against a measure that converges on continuous functions. But in addition, it contains the universal enveloping algebra of the group. In the usual way that an element of the universal enveloping algebra can be viewed as giving you a distribution on locally analytic functions at the origin of the group. It contains the universal enveloping algebra. So you can, on the one hand, think of it as some exotic completion of the universal enveloping algebra, or on the other hand, as some exotic completion of the Iwasawa algebra. And this really somehow captures, I think, the trade-off between these two things is part of what makes this interesting, because this, of course, makes you think you're doing real Lie group theory, and this makes you think you're doing p-adic groups, and you can somehow do both of them. Okay, so as I remarked, it's in general not commutative and not Noetherian. Yeah. Oh, so if G is not compact, you can still form this space, but the multiplication now is only separately continuous. So in fact, the admissibility condition that I'm going to describe is done in the same way that we did it here. Namely, if you have a general compact group and you have a representation, then you test admissibility on compact groups. But there's a little bit, let me give you a concrete example of this for the group ZP. So once again, we're back in the classical period of p-adic integration. For the group ZP, the Iwasawa algebra is the Iwasawa algebra. I mean, as a ring, it's isomorphic to the formal power series. Actually, a better way to say it is the following, that K double brackets G. So maybe I should put it this way. If you think about the characters of this group, you can identify this with the open p-adic unit disk. I mean, any such character, psi, is of the form A goes to 1 plus X to the A, where X is in this open disk, over CP. This becomes the convergent, the bounded convergent series on G hat. And D of G becomes all convergent, all rigid analytic convergent series on the open unit disk. So this is a particular case, and this ring also was studied by Lazard. I mean, both of these, in this situation, this whole picture was worked out in the early 60s by Amis and Lazard. And it somehow is the classical theory of p-adic integration for functions on ZP. Okay. Good. So now, the strategy, which I won't have time to talk about in too much detail for finding admissible representations, is to study this ring B of G. So for admissibility, we identify a subcategory of D of GK modules, which we call rather unimaginatively co-admissible. Now, in the interest of getting on to the other applications, I'm not going to, I think, go into this in detail. Let me just say that the strategy behind this is, in this particular case, G hat, the p-adic open unit disk, is a rigid analytic Stein space. And so the ring of functions on it is what would be called in complex analysis a Stein algebra. And if you take the modules, which look like the global sections of coherent sheaves on a Stein space for a Stein algebra, this is a good category of modules that were studied in complex analysis. Now, D of G in the general case is unfortunately not commutative, but it turns out that to all intents and purposes, it behaves in some sense like the ring of functions on a Stein space. And you can introduce a category of coherent sheaves. I mean, there's no space, but you can talk about coherent sheaves, and you can talk about Stein modules. And the key point is that this ring, it's a projective limit of Banach algebras, and you say that a module is co-admissible if the module is a projective limit of finitely generated modules over these Banach algebras. And that turns out to give you an abelian category. So this is an abelian category. And as I mentioned before, this is somehow the goal because it settles all of these questions about images of maps being closed and so forth. And it's an abelian category, and you say that V is admissible. If V prime is co-admissible. V here is now a locally analytic representation. So if V is locally analytic, and I should say, it's a locally analytic representation and on a vector space of compact type. That's now necessary. Because we want to be able to go back and forth. I mean, compact type means reflexive, so passing to the dual, we lose no information. And maybe I can make one other remark. I mean, this is rather vague, I admit, but just as a final remark, finitely presented modules are co-admissible. So not all co-admissible modules are finitely presented, but at least as far as this ring is concerned, if you have a module which is finitely presented, then you know you have a co-admissible module, and therefore you have an admissible representation. Okay. So let me give you some examples. Go back. So in this, remember my list of examples, which actually I think is here, but is now in, you can't see it all at once. But so the finite, all those examples, all earlier examples, are co-admissible. Are admissible. I guess I listed representations. But in particular, let me just make some remarks. So a smooth representation is admissible in our sense precisely when it's admissible in the Langland sense or the Harishchandra sense. So, I mean, in that sense, we do somehow achieve, I mean, we haven't wrecked anything by expanding the category in this way. And also, we can characterize the smooth representations. I mean, V is smooth admissible. So if V is admissible, then V is smooth if and only if the Lie algebra acts trivially. This somehow isn't, this is what you would expect. I mean, to say that the Lie algebra of G acts trivially is to say that the functions that make up the space are somehow locally constant. And that's what you would want. And I wanted to, also the induced representations are admissible, but let me, in order to once again bring in something related to Shimura varieties, let me go back to Drinfeld's symmetric space. So if you take X to be the symmetric space, and you consider, for example, the I forms on X, this is a nuclear Fréchet space, and it has a D of G L D plus 1 of QP, let's say, dimension D. It has such an action. And so the conjecture is that this is coadmissible in general. Now, this is known in some cases. So in particular, you see, this would mean that its continuous dual is an admissible locally analytic representation. And I think I wish I knew how to prove this. I feel like I should be able to, but I have really been stuck for a long time. So let me just make some remarks. So in the one-dimensional case, and actually in the, if D is 1 or 2, this is known. This is known. And if I is 0 or D, so in other words, the functions on the symmetric space or the D forms on the symmetric space, this is known. And let me draw you the picture for the case of omega 1, I mean for the case of the one-dimensional case. This is due to Morita. And in that case, the picture looks like this. You have O goes to omega 1, goes to K, goes to H1 Durham, goes to 0, and we're interested in the duals of these spaces. So I'll draw it this way. If I take O mod K and its dual, and I take omega 1 and its dual, the Schneider and Stuhler theorem tells you that the Durham cohomology is dual to the Steinberg representation. So on the dual side, you have here the Steinberg representation. Morita proved that this space is the locally analytic functions on P1, modulo constants. This, of course, is the locally constant functions on P1 modulo constants. And so this is a piece of the exact sequence, of the sequence of spaces which I put up at the beginning. And this map from here to here is you take the derivative. Okay, so as a representation, the image of this map is something induced. I won't specify it exactly, but. So here you have C infinity, P1 mod K. In the general case, Schneider and I suffered through an ridiculously complicated calculation of what omega D was, and we can prove using that calculation that it's admissible. But we have to somehow use a complete description of what this space is, and it would be very nice to have some kind of a general theorem that allows you to conclude that these spaces are coadmissible without actually having to compute them. So this turns out to be really a question about integral transforms and having closed image and so forth. Okay, so now I think I will skip ahead and talk a bit about the work of Breuil. Maybe I should put here, this is the situation for GL2. And it's, as I mentioned, really due to Morita long before any of this other stuff came up. Okay, so now let's go to the problem of arithmetic. So the question is, if one was going to have some kind of a local Langlands correspondence, one should have two sides. One should have some arithmetic, and on the other side, one should have representation theory, something automorphic. So I have to say that at present, it's unclear what goes on either side of this correspondence. For example, on the arithmetic side, you could put p-adic representations of the Vey group of some kind. You could put p-adic Galois representations. I mean, it's especially this question of the Vey group versus the Galois group, I mean, I think is really unclear at this right now. But you need to put something over here. And then the question is, what do you put on the other side? And okay, so at the very least, you see you have kind of two choices of types of representations. You have these Banach-based representations, and you have the locally analytic representations. And which is the right one to put there. Maybe I should remark that if you set out optimistically to follow Langlands, and let's say you decide to start with the simple case where you take induced representations, you could ask yourself, well, suppose I just do the following. I take two characters, and I view them as a character of the maximal torus in GL2, and I induce them, and I make a locally analytic representation, which is induced, and I try to associate this on the other side of the picture to the corresponding Vey group representation where I use class field theory. You run into the following very annoying problem. In smooth representation theory, when you induce two characters, it doesn't matter. I mean, the order of the two characters doesn't matter. But it turns out that these analytic representations, it matters whether you put, which character you put, so to speak, if you have the upper triangular matrices, there's a difference between the two possible positions, and you get a different representation. It's not symmetric. So, I mean, right away you're in trouble. And a second thing that you have in the Langlands world is that any smooth all these smooth representations, you can arrange them to be the quotient of something induced. And this somehow gives you a way to, by introducing the N operator, to kind of keep track in the situation where you get something reducible to organize these things. But in the locally analytic case, you can never get the smooth representation as a quotient. It's always a subthing. You can't rearrange the components. There's some dimension restrictions on the category of modules. So the naive approach seems to fail. And one consequence of that is that whereas what I'm about to describe treats some very fancy Galois representations, what to do with the reducible ones, we have absolutely no idea. Okay. So what Breuil does is he says, on the one hand, he wants to construct a correspondence of the following sort. On this side, we're going to put, let's say, irreducible, and of course, if you'll forgive me, I'll restrict myself to GL2 of QP. We want to put on this side irreducible two-dimensional p-adic Galois representations. Maybe into QP bar. And on this side, he proposes that we associate to such a thing a Banach space representation. So let me call this V. Which we'll call B of V, which is supposed to be irreducible and unitary in the sense that the norm is G invariant. I mean, it's not really unitary, but with a G invariant norm. And topologically, it should be topologically irreducible and unitary and admissible in our sense that I mentioned earlier. Now, the goal should be that this space should characterize this space. I mean, up to isomorphism. Now, that means you have to be able to recover a lot of stuff because these two-dimensional representations are classified by, let's take, not all, but here potentially semi-stable. So on this side, you have a Fontaine module. You have some kind of two-dimensional module, M, with a Frobenius map, phi, and some kind of a filtration on it, and an N operator, some kind of unipotent operator, nilpotent operator. Just maybe the way to think of it is that somehow the phi determines the characteristic polynomial of Frobenius, and if we forget about the N and stick, let's say, to the crystalline case, then the filtration somehow characterizes lifts of something modulo P. Now, what happens on the other side? Oh, and also, I mean, as part of all this data, you can extract some Hodge-Tate weights. So what he proposes doing with all of this stuff is the following. From the M and the phi, you get a characteristic polynomial of Frobenius. And to such a characteristic polynomial of Frobenius, you can associate a smooth representation according to the usual local Langlands correspondence with some normalization, but I won't worry about that. So from phi, you get a smooth representation. Now, from the Hodge-Tate weights, you get an algebraic representation. I mean, you view the Hodge-Tate weight somehow as a character of the maximal torus, and you associate to that an algebraic representation. What else do we need here? Let's, for the moment, forget the N. So I'm going to stick, for the moment, to the crystalline case, where the N is zero. And then we have this issue of, okay, so now what have we got? We've got a smooth representation and an algebraic representation, so we'll call this... what does he call it? B of V smooth and B of V alge. And now we can take their tensor product. To get one of these locally algebraic representations. But of course we still haven't, I mean this is not yet enough information because to determine the representation because of the filtration data, which we haven't yet imposed. So what he proposes is that somehow the filtration is used to construct a completion of this. That is to say, it gives a norm on this space, a G-invariant norm, giving rise to B of V by completion. So somehow the F data, the filtration, is contained in the completion here. Now, he has some... He studies this in a particular case where if you take crystalline two-dimensional representations of GL2, he has a classification of them. And so an example of what this correspondence might predict is that, so it turns out that for such representations over QP here, the filtration is irrelevant. I mean, up to isomorphism, there's no extra data added by the filtration. So what his recipe should mean is that somehow this completion, there should be only one. There should be only one invariant norm on this space. Okay, now, he finds an invariant norm in certain, and I won't go into all the technicalities of what has to be, all the hypotheses of which there are many, but under the conditions where it's crystalline and you're in a case where the filtration doesn't matter, he works out what this, he has a classification on that side, and he proposes specific examples of what these should be, and under certain conditions he proves that at least there is such a completion. And he does the following kind of amazing thing. If you have such a Banach space, you can take its unit ball and reduce it modulo P and get a mod P representation. And he takes different examples of these of this data, gets different things here, reduces the mod p and finds intertwining operators modulo p, then he conjectures that if there's an intertwining operator modulo p on this side, there's some relation between the reductions of the representations on this side, and he finds numerical evidence to show that this is correct. So in some sense, this would be compatible with reduction modulo p. Now, you might ask, where do the analytic representations fit into this picture? Well, one theorem which I didn't mention is that if you have a Banach space representation like this, inside it, you can take the analytic vectors. And one of the things that we prove is that this is an exact functor, and also that the passage somehow from, I mean, to pass from a Banach space to the locally analytic vectors is exact. And so you could, instead of taking the Banach space, somehow you could take the analytic vectors instead, and they might have additional constituents. So a second way of looking at this is that different ways of including this locally algebraic representation into an analytic representation as a constituent is another way of looking at this filtration. Okay? And then I'm really over time. Let me make one other comment about Breuer's work, which I think is quite exciting. And that is, what about in the semi-stable case where it's not crystalline? So in that case, the filtration matters. Well, semi-stable, non-crystalline. Then the N matters. And in fact, so on the, so to speak, automorphic side, the corresponding representation looks like sim k minus 2 tensor the Steinberg representation. But there are different N's that you can put on. And his picture proposes that there should then be different completions of this algebraic representation corresponding to the choice of N on the other side. And he uses the theory of modular forms for Drinfeld's upper half space to construct examples of different completions of this space corresponding to modular forms, which somehow, I mean, are related to the L invariant of such in such a situation. So, I mean, he has a lot of very suggestive evidence, even though there's more things somehow which live outside of his picture still than actually live inside it. There's a lot of very interesting clues in what he's done. And as I said, I didn't think I would have time to talk about Emerton, and I don't, although he has 300 pages on his website that I highly recommend to everyone. Okay, thank you.